Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we take an inside look at how writers navigate the shoals of literary genre and how they really see themselves, despite what those book blurbs might say, in My True Genre. Have you ever noticed that movie posters for quirky independent films almost always have a yellow background? If so, then you've probably also noticed that chick lit novels tend to have pastel covers scrawled with fashion designery cartoons. If it's bold, solid-coloured type over a grainy monochrome photograph, then you've definitely got yourself a thriller. And nothing screams teen angst as loudly as those black and blood-red covers that have been vampirising the young adult section since the Twilight series first came out. Whether we like it or not, genre demarcation is a primary weapon in the modern bookseller's armoury, and it percolates through every stage of the publication process. These days, a book's genre, or perceived genre, is seen as having a major effect on its potential saleability. But where's the poor writer in all of this? And what of that bane of the literary agent, the writer who likes to genre hop? We asked a number of writers about the compartmentalisation of genre and how they fitted into it, and where they felt their own true genre lay. The non-fiction writer Michael Bywater is satisfyingly offended by the whole concept of neat genres and the marketing games that publishers like to play.
I have a problem with genre in general, which is I think it's an invention of marketing people. Because what marketing people do, bless them, is they exist under a terror of something new. A marketing person will come up to a writer or a filmmaker or whoever it may be and say, you know that extraordinary thing you did last year? Absolutely out of left field, nobody could have foreseen it coming, completely rewrote the entire paradigm, made a fortune, terribly popular, marvellous. Yeah. Can you do another one just like that?
A good example is Ian Banks, who was also Ian M. Banks, because that was to distinguish his science fiction books from his not science fiction books, almost as though he needed a different brand. You know, these ones were Toblerone and those ones were Crunchy. And it seems to me strange that a man who could write as well as he could write and had such an inventive, fertile and pure storyteller's mind should have to flag what the thing is about before anyone will dare to buy it. If you want to go to the lunacy of genre, I suppose you would say that Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose is in the same genre as the awful Da Vinci Code. But knowing they're in the same genre tells you absolutely nothing about the quality and the scope and the intelligence and the human sympathies and understandings of the book.
Novelist Livy Michael agrees that the commercial world has hung up on genre consistency, but writers can have good reasons for making a change.
I'm one of those writers who has written in several genres, and this is not necessarily an advantage. I always thought that you just had to follow what you really wanted to do in writing. But in fact, the commercial world would prefer you to write the same kind of thing over and over again. However, I started off with contemporary fiction that was, I suppose, roughly in the area of social realism, and the characters were all women. Then when I started writing for children, I wrote fantasy and historical. And I've gone back to writing for adults now with historical fiction. And a number of people have queried that and are saying, you know, why aren't I writing contemporary fiction? Which, of course, is a question that is quite hard to answer, why you write what you do. I have written in different genres, and gradually the historical one has taken over. And it's because this is where increasingly I find the stories that there is something when you find something that you want to write about that not only lights the spark, but you can always tell the difference that this is going to have enough substance in it for you to keep writing about it.
Livy managed to change genre, but what about writers who don't quite fit their assigned genre in the first place? That's a dilemma that has long affected novelist Emma Darwin.
The book trade thinks that I write historical fiction, and it thinks that I write it on the literary commercial boundaries, also across the men's, women's fiction boundary as well, which is quite a lot of stools to fall between. And I do see why they think that. I'm not one of the people who gets cross with the fact that the industry needs to know what it's selling, because it needs to know who to try and sell it to. That seems to be perfectly reasonable. But I don't think that I write historical fiction. I think that I write fiction about history. Fiction which is all about how we feel the past and how the past feels, which is why I often find myself writing parallel narrative with the stories that have, you know, two different strands in different times, because it's the relationship between the two which fascinates me most. I do think you can't, in the end, totally change what your writing core is. It's like your body. You can be fitter or less fit. You can be slimmer or more tanned or paler or whatever. You can work out in the gym. You can have cosmetic surgery. But in the end, your skeleton is your skeleton. Your skin type is your skin type. You can't change that. And some days you don't get on with it, and some days you're very happy with it. But in the end, it's you. And I think while it's economically sensible and can be creatively challenging to try things that don't come so naturally, to challenge your defaults, to try stuff that might not work, to risk all with something that might be a disaster, I do think in the end, there's no point in, you know, trying to have orthopedic surgery in order to make your legs longer. You know, you are the shape you are, and you do much better to learn to make the most of that.
The novelist Mavis Cheek agrees with Emma about the importance of writing like yourself, possibly because of her own ill-fated attempts to write like somebody else.
With my first book, which never got published, thank God, it did get read by an agent who later became my agent, a wonderful woman called Imogen Parker. And she wrote to me and said, "I'm not interested in publishing your book, but it has some good bits in it. If you're passing my door, I'll give you 5 minutes of my time to tell you what I think about it." Obviously, I was passing her door, strangely, the next morning at 7:30. And she said, "In this book, you suppress every glimmer of humour as it rises. You put a lid on it. Why do you do that?" And I said, "Well, you know, comedy's not art." You know, at that point, it was M. Cheek and James Joyce pushing out the bounds of 20th century fiction. Thank God that went. And Imo said, "Well, why don't you write like you speak?" I thought that was an interesting idea. And that was how I discovered my authorial voice. I have actually just embarked upon attempting a murder mystery thriller book, only because everybody else in the world seems to be doing it, and it seems to be a great success. So I thought, well, I could have a go at that. And I fell very, very flat on my face in it. I'm no good at plot, I realise. I haven't a hope in hell, because you have to plot those things. And I kept finding myself getting much more interested in the characters and their involvement with each other. I sent it to my agent, who waited a long time, unlike him, to get back to me to tell me he didn't think it had worked, but I knew already.
Inevitably, of course, commercial concerns do sometimes have to trump a writer's deeper preferences, especially for writers trying to make a living from their work. Non-fiction writer Max Adams knows all about this.
One thing I can say is that the writing that I do commercially is not my true genre. That I think I can be fairly certain of. I think of myself as either a poet or a novelist. I may have had a poem published 30 years ago. Never had a novel published, despite my very best efforts. And yet, as far as I'm concerned, I am a novelist. Professionally, I write biography. I'm trying to get away from it desperately, and my publisher is desperately trying to stop me from getting away from biography. I can't. You know what? I'm a biographer. I can't stand biography. I don't read biography. I don't like it. I don't really admire it. Apologies to all those great biographers. So I suppose in writing biography, the only way I can justify it to myself is by subverting it and trying to make it as unbiographical as I possibly can. I've just written a rather short, quirky, very indulgent, anecdotal book about trees. Quite often, biography is full of footnotes and references. Justify, justify. Name your sources, sir. And anyway, I just escaped from that to write a short book about trees, which is really just about me and trees. And I've rather enjoyed it. And I rather hope that I might use that as a lever to open the door to escape from biography, or at least find a different thing to do with biography. But anyway, my publishers have just offered me the chance to write another goddamn biography, so what can you do, you know? I mean, what can you do? It's a contract, isn't it?
What happens, though, when the obstacles to writing one's true genre are internal ones? Non-fiction writer James McConachie is brutally honest about his own struggles.
It's a bit unfortunate, but I suspect that my true genre is fiction, or at least I hope it's fiction. And it's unfortunate because I write non-fiction. So how did this happen? Where did it all go wrong? Well, no child that I've ever met grows up thinking, I really want to write non-fiction. No, they want to write stories. And I think, like most writers, the desire to write began early. And it began with reading novels. It's always what I thought I would do. I still hope I will do it. But somewhere along the line, I became derailed. And it's a good thing. I don't want to suggest that writing non-fiction is something I regret. The reason I'm writing non-fiction is because every time I've tried to write fiction, I've become beset with what I can only describe as an anxiety of purpose. As long as I'm writing, communicating or educating in some way, as long as I'm in some way adding to the pool of knowledge that might be lapping out into the world, I feel like there's a reason for doing it. When I sit and work on the unwritten, unfinished novel, I cannot escape the thoughts of, why am I doing this? Is this merely indulgent, self-indulgent? As long as I'm writing non-fiction, those anxieties go away. I'm doing something with a result. I'm hopefully letting a reader know something that they didn't know before. There's a didactic element, I suppose.
So as Max and James suggest, sometimes writers can't occupy their true genre for practical or personal reasons. More oddly, though, sometimes a writer can be completely wrong about what that true genre actually is. Here's a rueful Simon Ray pointing out the difference between what he'd like to be remembered for and what he's actually best at.
I've been a biographer, I am a poet, I'm now a writer of stories for younger readers. I think if I were going to choose one to go on my gravestone, it would be poet. But I'm now currently enjoying a late burst in my new role as storyteller and a novelist. And given that I find, amazingly, it far easier to write a page-turning adventure story than anything else I've ever tried, I have to assume that my true genre really is storyteller. Which in a way is frustrating, because I spent most of my writing career not being a storyteller.
The playwright David Spencer also started out with poetry, but he decided that his talents lay elsewhere. Nonetheless, it was a poet's love of words and their music that showed him the necessary next step.
I have written short stories and poems. I started wanting to be a poet, but I felt I wasn't good enough. I never really had that precision that you need in the language to be strong in poetry, and I couldn't find a consistent voice as well, and I found it really, really difficult to know where to break the lines up so that it looked right, which might sound daft, but I'm sure if there are any poets out there listening to this, they won't feel it's stupid at all. I think it takes quite a lot of good judgment that. But they are linked to playwriting. I was always particularly interested in the sound of the words, and so I write for the voice. To be completely honest, I think where my main interest lies, what I'm best at, and what I always return to is theatre, and that's writing theatre scripts. You don't really write a play or a production, that's what happens when other people get involved. But I like the discipline of the theatre script, and I've been doing that for well over 20 years now.
As some of these writers have suggested, contemporary genre labels can feel more like a marketing construct than a natural demarcation. As a writer, Lynn Webster Wild is resigned to the commercial necessity of genre labels, but she also believes in the possibility of transcending them.
I suppose the genre that I tend to work in is that of the metaphysical tale, which is operating at several different levels. The thing about genres is that if you want to be commercially successful, you have to pay attention to it. If you want to make a Hollywood film, if you want to write a best-selling book, you do need to pay attention to your genre. You need to know whether it's rite of passage, thriller, horror, whatever. But I wouldn't push that too much with beginning writers, because really it's more important to learn to write properly to start with. And then the best people are the people who have something to say, and they need to say that thing. And then they will either find the right genre naturally, or they will make their own genre. Like David Simon with The Wire. He created the new long-form television serial because he had something that could only be said in that form.
The biographer Jan Marsh isn't at all afraid to consider genre hopping.
One always seeks a new, a different genre. Say, like someone who's composed symphonies and now attempts opera or film music. Currently, I like subjects with a strong visual element. I find the account of how a painting or sculpture comes into existence ever fascinating. But I also choose subjects that I know little about, the subjects that I would like to find a book on. The subject of one previous book, which was the life of hermaphrodite sculptor Fiore de Henriquez, drew me into another area of total ignorance when I started. And of course now suddenly the experience of transgender and intersex conditions seems everywhere. So it's partly intellectual curiosity that drives my choice of subject.
On the other hand, novelist and classicist Elizabeth Speller suggests that it's not genre but skills that really matter from the writer's point of view.
I'm interested in the whole idea of genre because I write across four genres, I suppose, five perhaps. And as far as I'm concerned, I think the same skills and things and technical skills and understanding of writing apply to all of them. And I don't see very sort of strong boundaries between them. I do think academic writing is clearly a different skill. Apart from that, I think you're trying to present a subject, fictional, non-fictional, or an image in poetry in a way that connects with somebody else's imagination.
Non-fiction writer Julian Evans makes a similar point when he suggests that his own writing process is his true personal genre.
I think my true genre is a will-o'-the-wisp, and I say that because I've written a travel book, I've written a long authorised biography of a travel writer, and although it may not be very obvious, I think there's a definite kinship between the two, but it's in something formal and quite mercurial in the construction of both. My travel book was about a journey back to a part of the world which I'd known as a child, Australia and the South Pacific, and what interested me in it was just as much as the places that I went to and the things that happened there, was the way of telling the story. So it was as much a quest of how to tell a story and how to compose a journey into a book. It had to be put together. So my genre was how to put that together and what degree of irony, what degree of self-reflection, what degree of outwardness towards the reader in terms of entertaining the reader, should it contain. And when I came to write the second book, which was a biography of Norman Lewis, that was, again, the sort of ruling passion.
Poet and non-fiction writer Nicholas Murray is a fan of the polygeneric and points out that fiction and non-fiction aren't nearly as different as the marketing department might think.
I think the notion, and it sounds a terribly old-fashioned term, the man of letters, quite apart from its gender specificity, has something to be said for it. I never had the luxury of being able to concentrate on one thing, like just writing poetry or just writing novels. I've written all sorts of things. I've worked as a journalist in a slightly unglamorous trade magazine end of the business. I've written biographies. I've written two novels. I've written poetry. I've written books about travellers, I've written a lot of essays, reviews. My notion of the writer is someone who is versatile and polygeneric, perhaps, who is able really to turn their hand to anything. And also I think there's an awful lot of crossover. I mean, I teach something called creative nonfiction at the City Lit, and
we range across a number of types of writing, and I'm always saying that the commerce between fiction and non-fiction is very busy, and that the boundaries are porous, and many non-fiction books have the qualities of fiction and vice versa. So I think versatility and the ability to turn yourself to anything if you're a dedicated writer is a good thing.
And finally, the last word goes to a true polygeneralist, the poet, novelist and librettist Ron Butlin, who finds his genre home wherever he currently lays his writing hat.
I write in several genres, if we can call them genres. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's just words, and I use them in different ways. Sometimes they reach the right-hand side of the page, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're then taken up by actors, sometimes I read them aloud, sometimes they just stay on the printed page. The way I started was as a poet. And that is something that has continued right through my life. I've now published 7 collections of poetry. After the first book of poems, I found myself rather surprisingly writing prose, which was a complete surprise to me, short stories. And then I went on to do novels. And since then, I've done journalism and also opera libretti and plays. So lots of wide range things, but basically it all works the same way for me, which is I get a few words in my head, I treat them as I do a piece of music, don't try to understand it, understand what it means, I just let it kind of hum away like a piece of music in my head, and I try and hear the next bit, and sometimes it turns into a poem, sometimes a short story, sometimes a novel. I don't really have a particular kind of, you know, this is my favourite, you know. I find that, quite genuinely, the one that I feel most important is the one that I'm working on at any given moment.
That was My True Genre. The featured writers were Michael Bywater, Livy Michael, Emma Darwin, Mavis Cheek, Max Adams, James McConaughey, Simon Ray, David Spencer, Lynn Webster-Wild, Jan Marsh, Julian Evans, Nicholas Murray and Ron Butlin. You can find out more about all of these writers on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 54, which was recorded by the Writers Aloud team and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 55, the novelist Jonathan Tulloch speaks with Francis Burns about how his faith and his love of nature are an important part of his writing rituals. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.